Yeah, no, that would be pretty sweet if we had a studio like this. Yeah. Just come in and the walls are decorated entirely with, like, you know, I don't know, Munsungan chert.
Yeah, one of those Mayan flaked eccentrics that look like a Klingon batholith hanging on the wall.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick here in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by a remarkably tan-looking Ken, who's just back from vacation. Or maybe he's not tan, maybe he's wearing a white shirt, it's hard to know, but you're back from Vancouver, Ken.
Yep, and surprisingly, Vancouver with the sun shining. So yes, I did get a little bit of sun, we did lots of walking, lovely city, everything was in full bloom.
Excellent, excellent. Did you go to Stanley Park and look at the totem poles?
We did, yes. Excellent. Yeah, we walked past them, went to the aquarium, which is also in Stanley Park, did the seawall.
Oh, very nice. And I understand that you have a cocktail spot recommendation.
Yeah. So the Sylvia Hotel, which is actually my in-laws suggested it. It's one of the first hotels that was on English Bay, which is on the, I guess, the west side of the peninsula, just south of Stanley Park. Beautiful spot. And this, it's like one of these old, like, I think 1920s hotels.
Oh, excellent.
And it's got a cocktail list that is very reminiscent of the 1920s.
That's fantastic.
So I had a really good take on a kind of like a bit of a take on a Negroni, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think that's the one you sent me the picture of. It was sort of
Yeah, it was delicious.
Yeah, it looked delicious. Yeah, well, that's excellent. And you had some good sushi, I understand.
Yeah, good sushi, good Indian food. Great. You know.
Did you take the family to see the Chili's in the Calgary airport?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had to walk by. It wasn't even open by when we were there. We were at the airport so early. At the Calgary airport so early, the Chili's wasn't even open.
Oh, wow. I would have thought they'd open special for you.
Yeah, well, you know, I missed out on my my huevos rancheros that day.
What a shame. And I understand that you've had it's been an eventful day there in Lethbridge at the department.
Yeah. So I wanted to shout out Matthew Sawchuk, MSc now. So Matthew successfully defended his thesis today, pulling apart the pile, analyzing the chronology and zooarchaeology of the head smashed in buffalo jump.
Oh, okay.
And so Matthew, actually a really talented student, has a BA in archaeology and a BSc in paleontology. And his thesis was a little bit of paleontology, a little bit of archaeology, and some really fascinating findings.
So. Okay, that's pretty exciting. Did everyone go out for buffalo steaks after? How does it work there?
So the chair of the committee, or the chair of the defense, actually suggests that we should go out for bison burgers, but we actually ended up going out for sushi at a place downtown.
Okay,
so.
Yeah, Lethbridge is known for its sushi.
Known for its sushi,
yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, congratulations, Matthew. That's very exciting. I wonder if we should get. I understand he passed with the very very minor revisions. So once those are in, and maybe give it a chunk of time, because no one should look at their thesis right after it goes in. You should
exactly. You should, well, I think we should probably try to do a whole head smashed in buffalo jump episode, maybe where I can wrangle Kevin and Sean and maybe Bob Daw from the Royal Alberta Museum and
excellent
and Matthew. So if you're listening, folks, you're on notice.
That's right.
That,
yes,
that season 4 of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast might feature some head smashed in buffalo jump content.
That's right. So Matthew, open the thesis and let it breathe like a fine Syrah, so it's ready to go, ready to go when it's time. But
exactly.
But you know, speaking of decadence, Ken, and speaking of things like a fine Syrah or a great cocktail at a 1920s bar in Vancouver, the listener may have noticed that it's possible that the title of our podcast has not kept up with the sort of importance and significance and maybe even the classiness of this podcast. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
And actually, ladies and gentlemen, that was just our IP lawyer who came in. And she came in and she whispered in Ken's ear that we should be a little bit careful about the idea that we might just be stealing one of our listeners' IP, which of course we would never do because as Ruby JD just said, it would be a real shame if we ended up mired in horrible, horrible legal consequences.
Exactly.
In fact, it could sink the whole budget for this podcast, which we should mention is now sponsored by the University of New Brunswick.
And APA and B, as long as the loan collectors don't, as long as the US UPS store doesn't come after me.
We owe some money to the UPS.
Yeah. For our mailbox.
Yeah. I feel like this could be like the beginning of a very bad 70s movie, you know, where it's like there's something very important in the mailbox, but someone forgot to pay for it.
Exactly.
But a mailbox we have paid for is our Google mailbox. And what is that address, Ken?
It is newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And one of the things we would use that for, listener, was if you had a new classy name for this podcast, you would send it there. I mean, or you could send it to us scrawled on a bottle of Balvenie Scotch, or I mean, even a good Canadian whiskey would be fine.
Exactly.
Because we're obviously buying Canadian
right
now.
We are patriots.
Yes. We are nothing if not patriots. Did you hear that, Canadian immigration? And so, Ken, what would we reward the listener who assigned such a name to this podcast and sent it to that email address?
Well, so Gabe, as you and the listener know, we've been trying various creative ways to raise money or to find sponsorship for the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. And while the lucky listener that renames the podcast gets a prize to take home if they come up with that name, this fortnight we're actually offering a package that will potentially put a bit of cash in our coffers to keep the lights on and keep Emmanuel making us sound smooth as butter.
Oh, fantastic.
So as we record this, we're actually approaching
one of my favorite... Are there tariffs on butter right now, Ken? Or how's butter?
No, we're protected in Canada.
Oh, good. Okay.
So as we record this, we're approaching one of my favorite celebrations of the year, Cinco de Mayo. And while I do not have any kind of Mexican heritage, I, like many of our audience, I'm sure, have been the beneficiary of this popular celebration of Mexican-American culture that originated in 1862 with the Mexican defeat of the Second French Empire in the First Battle of Pueblo, not to be confused with Mexican Independence Day, which is actually celebrated September 16th. And so, not only because of the exquisite cuisine that coincides with Cinco celebrations, the deluge of Instagram recipes for Corona cocktails, but also the festivities. Among them, one of the most entertaining forms of sport known as Lucha Libre Wrestling.
Oh, I was always just going in that direction. You know, it's funny. I was actually talking with our mutual friend Trevor about Lucha Libre Wrestling this weekend. We can discuss that
some other time. This fortnight, our prize package for that intrepid listener that renames the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast is packed with theatrics, grapples, pins, and of course, the iconic, colorful, and flamboyant masks that characterize the Lucha Libre sport.
Arriba, arriba.
So your prize package includes a fully paid taxi ride down to the Elks Club on Brunswick Street, where you'll make your way down to the basement and you've got two tickets for a ringside table with none other than your hosts. Once there, we'll be sharing dinner on the ringside and be treated to tacos of your choice. We've got pescado, pollo, carne asada, barbacoa, al pastor. You can choose corn or flour tortillas, birria style or plain.
Al pastor is actually Ken's Lucha Libre name.
Well, that'll come here. So that'll come with a side of rice, frijoles, and of course, it's paired with your choice of bottomless margaritas. And the listener will know that we do these right, Gabe. You can do regular spicy if you want, but we only add freshly squeezed lime juice, the finest reposado tequila, Cointreau, simple syrup, and we shake that thing done up however many shakes you think it's going to take. You, of course, could get cerveza done any style you want or just out of the bottle. Now, just to give a preview here, we got a heck of a card lined up for the listener that night, and we wanted to highlight some of the marquee matchups. What's this? It actually looks like you're in store for a treat, because we're not just your hosts for the evening. That's right, Gabe and I will be donning our own luchador identities. Yes, you'll be seeing a live trios squaring off in the ring and featuring friends of the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. And so we've got two trios squaring off, and in one corner, hailing all the way from Carlton County, the Baron of Barker's Point, the Mustachewad Master, none other than friend of the show, Senor Abajo. And there may not be any cornfields there, but you're about to get an earful from the Sacco Scallywag, the Biddeford Beauty, Dr. Senya en la Oria. And then these two will be captained in the ring by the menace from Millinocket, the Down East Dandy himself, your co-host, Dr. Basurero de Conchas. These luchadors will be squaring up against a team led by the Sultan of Stratigraphy, the Coastal Corporal himself, Dr. Matriz del Suelo, and the Connecticut Kid, the proto-historic prince, Dr. Cemental Italiano, and captained by none other than yours truly, the red-bearded rabble-rouser from the ridge, the silicate senator, Dr. Las Rocas San Reales. Yes, cheer and delight with us, listener, and bring your own mascaras, because you're in for a treat in this Cinco de Mayo showdown for all of the lucky listeners and those that one lucky listener who renames the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
My goodness, that sounds pretty exciting and like a great way to spend Cinco de Mayo. And so, Ken, where would they send? Where would the very lucky listener send that winning entry?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And you can also reach us on Instagram @new_brunswick_archaeology.
That's right, the place with the buenoest of no cheese.
Exactly.
And Ken, if you open up that mailbag, what do you see inside of it?
Well, we've got our usual pile of spam here. Bidon is giving us some, it starts, "Hello, boss. I hope you are well." He's got some suggestions on how to grow our YouTube channel.
Oh, good.
But we do actually have an email from Kenneth, and the title is CCRA. Oh, "Hi, gents. Thanks for interviewing me at CCRA. I've just listened to the podcast. Excellent stuff. Could I request one tiny change?" We've got an actual, this was like a real email. We had a guest on the podcast here, and I think in our show notes, we misidentified Kenneth Aitchison as associated with Landward Research, and he's actually with Headland Archaeology now. So Kenneth, we will change that. Actually, I can probably change that right now. It's actually one of my favorite tunes. It's been a while since we've had one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real testament both to our patience and to, I think, our abilities.
Exactly.
Yeah. We may be 0-4 with Shirk, but we're betting darn near 1,000 on
0-4 and doing worse, I think, as we go.
Yes, we are. Yeah, we are the we've started off with Shirk like Raffy Devers started the season at the plate this year, listener. It's been pretty bleak.
So that is it for the mailbag today. It's less a mailbag and more of a Hakuna Arata. Mm-hmm. We will send it back to the listener here. We're in store for another one of our climate change archaeology series.
Human environmental interact.
Yes, exactly. Featuring a friend and colleague, Dr. Matthew Betts from the Canadian Museum of History. He's the curator of Eastern Archaeology, Eastern Canadian Archaeology. But yes. I think it's just Eastern Archaeology. Isn't that what his title is?
I'm not sure. This watch us screw this up in the show notes twice. We just can't get people's affiliations correct. the archaeology is excellent, but the... But we're not very good at people's CVs here. But we'll have to check that. I've got him listed here as, curator of Eastern Archaeology. But I assume the Canadian is implied, perhaps?
Yeah, since it's the Canadian Museum of History. Because usually if you were a curator of Eastern Archaeology, they would think that you were working in quite a different part of the world.
Yeah, well, Matt's very Eastern in his worldview.
Very Zen.
Very Zen, exactly. And Matt's going to be talking to us about erosion and also a little bit of a brief discussion of underwater archaeology as well. That's got some,
that's right,
some expertise in shipwrecks that he's also going to share with you. And so without further ado, listener, we're going to step back into the TARDIS here, or forward into the TARDIS. I'm really sure what direction. And we will pick up the show with Hit Pieces.
That's right. Talk to you soon, listener.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Matt Betts. Matt was educated at the University of Toronto and is currently the curator of Eastern Archaeology at the Canadian Museum of History. He's authored numerous articles and a handful of books, including Subsistence and Culture in the Western Canadian Arctic, Placemaking in the Pretty Harbor, and the Archaeology of the Atlantic Northeast. In addition to his archaeological writing, he's also an expert on the Sir John Franklin expedition, and he created the model and plans of HMS Terror that were exhibited at a number of major museums, and he also authored the book HMS Terror, the Design, Fitting, and Voyages of the Polar Discovery Ship. He's also the past head of the Canadian Archaeology Association Climate Change Committee, which is what we're mostly going to talk to him today about climate change. Thanks for joining the show, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for coming back on.
I'm happy to be back. Thank you very
Matt,
much.
Matt, I think this is your second or third visit?
Second.
Okay, so you got one more before you get the jacket.
Okay, with a third potential. A smoking jacket
on the third one, yep.
We won't really smoke. We'll just wear the jacket.
Exactly.
We're working on planning you, Matt, to talk to a third one. You're one of the only people we've ever had on who already has the third episode scheming.
Yeah.
Well, I'm interested in culture history and its application in areas where there hasn't been as much research. So you'll be interested to know that Maritime shares many aspects of its research trajectory and development of archaeological practice with the Baltics.
Really? Oh, that's very cool. And I mean, so one of the challenges to culture, like building culture history today, is obviously the impact of climate change and climate change on archaeology and erosion. And that's what we've got you here today for. And so you've worked in both the Arctic and in the Atlantic Northeast. You've also served as we mentioned, as the head of the CAA Climate Change Committee. So just kind of at a broad scale, what are the biggest climate threats to Canada's archaeological record?
What aren't the climate threats to the Canadian archaeological record? We're in the midst of an unmitigated heritage crisis, the likes of which has never been experienced by the discipline. The rapid pace of climate change within the last 40 years is creating a situation in which large portions of the Canadian archaeological record are at risk, and large portions have already been destroyed. This has been described as a global heritage crisis, and as I always say, Canada sits at the apex of this crisis because we're experiencing more climate change at a greater pace than almost any country in the world. And of course, we have the largest coastline in the world and the largest freshwater ecosystem. And most of the effects are happening along the coastlines and along the river systems.
And so is it the coastline and river systems? Is that why Canada's experiencing these effects at a greater level than other places, or are there other factors?
It's also because we're a northern country, and so the river systems, the crustacean systems, the coastline is a factor, but we also have more permafrost than anywhere else, and of course permafrost is being lost at a exceedingly rapid pace. For archaeologists who know about permafrost, and for people who are listening to the podcast, permafrost can preserve things in an exceptional state. You get things like feathers and hair and organic tissue preserved. But when permafrost disappears, a site organic material, even bone, can turn to mush within 3 years. And so that's the sort of thing the Arctic specialists are facing. In southern regions, it's the combined effects of forest fires, soil denudation from droughts, increased periodicity of heavy storm events, rainfall, and of course the incremental sea level rise that's occurring and has been occurring for the last 4,000 years.
Yeah. So what you're talking about kind of scaffolds on, the listener will recognize. So this is part three of sort of our climate change, talking about climate change and the archaeological record. I guess maybe it might be part four by the time this airs. Is that right, Gabe? I can't remember. Robin was part two. So Matt, Mike would be part three. Anyway,
It's accelerating like greenhouse gas emissions.
And what you're talking about, permafrost and forest fires, and then pushing out to the coast, and these like, and there's a combined thing where the storm frequency and amplitude along combined with sea level rise, right? And it's not just natural sea level rise anymore; it's being compounded by a bunch of other factors.
That's right. And so it's not just the sea level rise, it's the increased intensity and periodicity of these massive storm events. And so we have larger frequency of hurricanes coming up the East Coast. Every time there's a hurricane, we have up to 1 meters, sometimes pushing up to 3 meters storm surges. And those are the really destructive events that really can remove meters of coastline in a single storm.
And so, Matt, in, you did an article in Canadian Geographic that we'll link in the show notes here, and you described coastal erosion of archaeological sites as a, in terms of a burning libraries metaphor. And so could you explain a little bit what you meant by that when you described the coastal erosion of archaeological sites as being like a burning library?
Yeah, well, that's obviously a reference to the Great Library of Alexandria and the incalculable loss to history that happened when it burned, except all these archaeological sites can be considered to be libraries amongst themselves, some with a very rich history to tell, some with a little snippet to tell. But essentially, we have thousands of these libraries on fire, actually, maybe tens of thousands. We don't know where they are. We don't know how big the fires are. And unfortunately, just like the Library of Alexandria, we have no means to put them out as of yet. And so we call it the burning library syndrome. And so essentially history being destroyed indiscriminately with no means to stop it.
Yeah. And also, I guess, sort of ironically, some of those books are about archaeology, but the books about climate baselines are also in the same library.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're exactly right. And so the record of human adaptation to climate change is also being destroyed. So the very knowledge we need to sort of stem the impacts of this climate change on modern peoples is also being destroyed. But, you know, the analogy can be pushed even further. And I sort of see an archaeological site like a book, right? And you can sort of think of the artifacts as the letters and words, the paragraphs as the features and contexts, and the pages as the stratigraphy, the sequence of events of the site. And when a hurricane wave hits a site, it dismantles the entire book. It rips the pages out. It scatters the words everywhere. And so you may have portions of the site left. You may have the words or letters left, but there's no way to put those back into a meaningful narrative anymore. And so people say, well, storms help us find sites because they reveal the artifacts within them. But the artifacts are virtually meaningless if they're not put together in the paragraphs and pages and words. And so you can't understand a site if the artifacts are scattered to the wind. It'd be just like taking all the words from a great novel and just pushing them everywhere without any ability to reconstruct it.
Yeah, and the listener will know, I've seen when Matt goes in the field, it actually really is like that Indiana Jones scene where he's got the pylon and he always likes to start by bashing through the floor of the local public library. There are actually towns in Nova Scotia we can't go to anymore. It's pretty
astonishing. That's what happens when the Diet Coke runs out.
That's right. Rage mode. Archaeology fueled by Diet Coke.
I use the Burning Libraries article in when we do a week of reading on coastal erosion in my Eastern Woodlands class, and the feedback that I get from the students in the discussion groups is really interesting because they think it's a really great way to. Because they read a bunch of kind of denser literature, but the metaphor itself really kind of drives home the message. And so for the listener who's trying to unpack some of this stuff as they're listening to this episode, reading that article, it's actually aimed at a public audience. And it's a way to sort of really kind of get a sense of how bad these things are and putting it into real world examples. And I think one of the things that you've talked about too, Matt, is that it's not just this loss of stories. For Indigenous groups, for example, it's a loss of, for example, some of the record of their long presence on the landscape. And so it's actually has potentially political and sovereignty issue, like legal issues, basically, for Indigenous groups, right?
Mm-hmm. It has a myriad effects. I mean, the historical information about their own past is one thing, but it has literal legal and rights-based and economic-based impacts on them. And so, as you're both aware, in Canada, federal, provincial governments obligate Indigenous people to prove their rights through long-term and enduring use of land and resources. And archaeology is one way that Indigenous people deploy that. But if you're in a situation where all of that information is being destroyed at a rapid pace, every wave, every storm, every rainfall event is washing away Indigenous rights, and there's no way to get that information back. Climate change has a real impact on Indigenous people's ability to deploy their rights in a meaningful and effective way.
We should pivot then too, Matt. You directed, over a decade of community-engaged archaeological research in coastal southern Nova Scotia, especially working with Acadia First Nation. And one of the points that you've made in that work is that changes to the environment, especially around things like the formation of Port Jolly Harbor, have a lot to do with how and why people lived in particular places in the past. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what we know about climate change before more recent anthropogenic-driven climate change, and sort of how people adapted to changing climate, what we know about these past climates before we'll turn to the sorts of changes that we've seen in Nova Scotia more recently.
Oh gosh, where do I begin? I mean, it starts at time immemorial, right? I mean, climate change is tied up in the entire story, oral and archaeological, of the indigenous populations of the Americas. Indigenous oral history records large glacial environments and large Pleistocene animals. The Mi'kmaq oral history talks about the giant beaver. Blackfoot oral history talks about the Blackfoot name is long-nosed woolly hair, which is a reference to a large mammoth, a woolly mammoth. As soon as the glaciers retreated, approximately 13,500 years ago, we see Indigenous people on the landscape. And that's exactly what occurred in the Maritime Provinces. And so the entire occupation of the land, as soon as it was inhabitable, is tied to climate change. And over that time, as the glaciers receded the process of inundation of the landscape of the coastline has been happening for tens of thousands of years. And as that coastline developed in the Maritime Provinces, people adapted to this developing coastline. And of course, the rise of one of the world's greatest marine ecosystems, which is the Gulf of St. Lawrence, George's Bank, Grand Banks off of Newfoundland. And of course, around 9,000 years ago, 9,000, 8,000 years ago, we start to see this really intensive adaptation towards the sea, which continues right up until the arrival and past the arrival of Europeans. And so in Port Jolly, for example, it's inundation which causes Port Jolly to be formed around 1,500 years ago. The harbor that exists today began to exist around then. And that was when we think that clam flats became established in the harbor. And that's exactly when you see people arriving in Port Jolly and making exceptionally specialized use of that resource. And so it's the slow increment of climate change and sea level change. People are intimately tied to that on the East Coast, and we can track both their movements, their settlements, and their economic adaptations to this slow change in climate. And not only just the sea level inundations, the perturbations in precipitation and sea surface temperature and air temperature. We can also track changes in adaptation and movement and technological change, social changes to those changes as well. So climate change has been going on as long as humans have been on the planet, but the rapid pace of climate change is what's really changing.
Yeah.
So it's what's really different in this area.
Yeah, the astute listener will just notice that that Matt was the lead author on the climate change article in Archaeology of the Atlantic Northeast, available wherever fine books are sold.
So yeah, so before we get into sort of what's lost, I think the listener would probably be interested. So you've talked a lot about how we can see, for example, ancestral Mi'kmaq groups basically moving into Port Jolly Harbor as it forms. They're intimately familiar and kind of are observing all of these environmental changes and are adapting to them and you know, finding new species to fish and new food to eat. How is it that, for example, we know as archaeologists, like how are you able to map the sort of the archaeological record in tying in with these environments? Like, what are some of the practical ways that you guys collect the data out there that gives you guys that story about human responses to environmental change in the past, basically?
Well, in Port Jolly, we were really lucky. I mean, we partnered with scientists from the University of Ottawa who took cores from ponds and lakes around Port Jolly and were able to reconstruct both the temperature and precipitation record. And they also did a reconstruction of the topography of the local coastline and were able to track that with known rates of sea level rise and were able to establish when the harbor was actually formed. And so we had this really high resolution record of not only changes in the coastline in Port Jolly, but changes in the precipitation and temperature and sea surface temperature in the area. And so we had a really high resolution, as you know, a really high resolution archaeological record with many radiocarbon dates that we were then able to match to these high resolution lake cores. And what's really interesting is that the major economic and settlement shifts in Port Jolly track really well with these changes in precipitation and temperature, and of course the establishment of the Port Jolly as a harbor, and even changes in the harbor over the last 1500 years as the harbor pushed up towards the head of the harbor where it is now. Sites moved towards the head of the harbor as the clam flats became inundated and became less productive. People moved up, and there was also a slight shift. Well, not even slight, but fairly profound shift from like marine resources towards terrestrial resources as the harbor changed. But whether or not that was primarily driven by climate change or driven by something else is I think that's still a little bit open to debate.
Interesting. And we'll put links in the show notes to the Port Jolly book so that the listener's interested in learning more about that.
And all summarized in our textbook as well.
they make a great companion set. If exactly, Father's Day is coming up, you know.
If you're a true completionist of Atlantic Northeast archaeology, this is one of the ones you got to have. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Matt, that is in some ways sort of the kind of, I think you've just described sort of the fun part of climate science in Port Jolly, because things are not as nice now, right? There's now the climate change is causing all sorts of trouble, and so. What sort of effects have you seen on the archaeological record just in Port Jolly? I think some of our listeners who might be familiar with that area would be curious to hear about that.
Yeah, the South Shore of Nova Scotia is probably one of the best and worst places to do archaeology in the country. And that is because when the archaeology is preserved, it's exceptionally rich. But the problem is finding it preserved. The southwestern shore of Nova Scotia has some of the most intense sea level rise in the country, projected to be over a meter over the next 100 years, which is exceptionally large. So if you add another meter of sea level rise onto these massive storm surges, and so the things that are 3 meters now are going to be 4 meters in 100 years. And so we've known for a long time that the coastal record of Nova Scotia is impacted by erosion and sea level rise. But what we were so lucky about in Port Jolly was because of the natural topography and all these bedrock pinned outcrops, a lot of the sites, at least on the western, southwestern portion of the harbor coastline, were protected from the large portion of erosion. However, on the eastern side, we did notice some erosion. While we were doing the Port Jolly work, as you remember, Gabe, we weren't able to access as many of the sites on the eastern side because they were owned by private landowners. There were less public lands. And so we focused on the better preserved side. And so for about 10 years, we were kind of in our little bubble, happy to have these preserved sites. But then we started to become interested in earlier time periods. And we knew that Port Jolly had become established around 1500 years ago. There weren't many indications that the harbor was occupied before that. And we knew that if we wanted to push our narrative back, and the community was for this, they wanted to know like what was the deeper history of their interaction and life on the southwestern Nova Scotia, that we'd have to go elsewhere. And we knew that would be a daunting task. And when we started looking elsewhere, that's when we realized that things were really, really bad. And so what we found in the little hints we had of it in Port Jolly were that sites were being sort of nipped at by the waves. The waves would come in and sort of dismantle these deposits called shell middens, which are primarily composed of clamshells. The clamshells are wonderful because they neutralize acidic soils. Everything's preserved really well. They also provide these sort of mounded matrices that can sort of level and transform the landscape. And so it's easy to find sites. But we noticed on the east side that those were sort of being dismantled by the waves, and you get this scatter of clamshells. But even on the eastern side of Port Jolie, those bins haven't been completely destroyed. They're still being nipped at. When we started to look outside of Port Jolie, we started with sites that had been found in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and we decided to go back and visit those sites. But what we found was that when we went back to visit them, most of them were no longer there. And if they were there, they tended to be either just a lithic scatter, which is a like stone tool scatter with a little bit of shell, or in the most intense scenario, there were no artifacts at all, just a smattering of shell that had been redeposited about, you know, from 50 to 100 meters further down the coastline. And we started calling those ghost middens because we knew that they had to be from shell middens, but probably redeposited by wave action. And so we found this again and again and again. Every time we visited the site, there's very few sites that we visited that were still intact. In fact, I think it was something like 68% of the sites we visited had been destroyed by wave action. When it came to sort of the final breakdown, over 90% of sites were either destroyed or severely impacted to the point where they're of limited, not limited cultural significance, because they're still very significant to the Mi'kmaq. The location is important, and what little data is left is important, but limited sort of archaeological ability to interpret them archaeologically.
Yeah. The listener will remember, too, how well Gabe's eyes are calibrated to this when we were out on Indian Island last summer with Katrina Sock. Katrina was walking us out there to show us a shell-bearing deposit that she had identified a couple years before. And Gabe recognized that it was gone because it looked exactly like how like these sort of sucked out shell-bearing deposits look when they become these ghost middens, basically.
Yeah, it's a phenomenon that seems to be sort of unique to, I've never heard it described this way in the literature in other locations. It seems to be sort of unique to the Maritime provinces, and it's incredibly frustrating because you know that there was a site there, and based on the distribution of the shell, you know it was probably a fairly large site. At only one of those sites did we even find a lithic scatter, and that was only, I think, because that a small portion of the site was still intact, or had been pushed up by waves and was intact because of that. So, and these were in locations which were pretty well sheltered, pretty high up. These sort of long, I mean, we can't really call them fjords in Nova Scotia because the topography doesn't support it. But there's these long, narrow sort of inland harbors that go right up these sort of river valleys. This basically inundation of these river valleys, and they should be pretty well protected. But the storm surges are so intense on the south shore that it just goes in and blasts everything away. And so we're in a situation, the situation is really dire. And so one of the reasons we wanted to learn more about pre-1500s, because we didn't have it in Port Jolie, but because it's also not particularly well known in the Atlantic in general. And that's because the sites are very rare. And so the sites that are like early, what we call early maritime woodland or archaic, are on the coastline in the maritime provinces are exceptionally rare. That's all due to, or we suspect, it's all due to inundation and erosion. To put a time stamp on how bad the erosion is in the maritime provinces. So in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people were finding sites that they thought were late archaic in age. So we're talking 4,000, 4,500 years ago, something, maybe even 5,000 years ago, something like this. When we did our surveys just a few years ago, we weren't able to find a single, even trace of a late maritime archaic site anywhere. We didn't find any traces of anything that was early maritime woodland either, which would be 3,000 or 2,500 years ago. So those sites were still available in the 70s. So in the span of time that I've been alive, which is 50 years, the Mi'kmaq and the archaeological community have lost the ability to understand, approximately, what, we're talking 3,500 years of history, archaeological history, that we cannot recover. It seems to be these sites, and we were hoping the whole time that we would find the one holy grail sort of site that preserved the long record. We just were not able to find one. And that's a significant problem, not only for archaeology, because As you know, like to understand those time periods archaeologically in the Maritimes is really important because we don't have a good cultural history for that time period. But for Indigenous people who are looking to deploy their rights, those time periods are when people are seemingly more adapted to the marine ecosystem. And so, you know, the evidence of swordfish hunting, the extreme evidence of deep sea sort of fishing or offshore fishing, sealing, all of that's really hard to find now. And so you have to reconstruct it using proxies from scallop draggers or the limited sort of stuff that collectors have picked up over the last century and a half.
Yeah, I think one of the ironies of that is that when, if you talk to, like, if you just went up to someone at the SAA and asked, you know, what do they know about Maine Maritimes archaeology, or even a member of the public, they would say, oh, it's shell heaps, and then also it's the late Maritime Archaic, right? Those are the really two iconic kind of aspects of this region's archaeology, and they're basically obliterated, which is sort of horrifying.
Absolutely. And the kinds of sites that are obliterated are the ones where we would get that like kind of full picture of what people are doing. You know, you have that preservation, so you're going to recover basically more things in an archaeological context in these coastal settings than you would, for example, even on a 3,000-year-old site in the interior, because you're not going to have the same kind of preservation conditions.
Absolutely. And it's not just Indigenous sites, too. I mean, we should make it clear that, you know, this location has one of the longest records of Euro-Canadian settlement and contact between Europeans and Indigenous peoples. And that record is all coastal, almost completely coastal. And that's obliterated as well. I mean, and so we have these situations where there's potentially like pretty early European sites on like places like Cape Sable Island, but the entire record is almost completely inundated or underwater. Trying to understand this sort of long-term effect of colonialism, with the best test case to study that is in the Maritime Provinces, but all of those sites are almost completely destroyed. And so how the challenge is real for archaeologists trying to do cultural history in our region, and the challenge is real for Indigenous people trying to piece together their own culture histories, because those sites are missing, and not only the sites, but the ability to sort of touch and look, see the tangible heritage, i.e. the archaeological record, that's taken from Indigenous people as well because of this climate change.
I was going to say, I think you anticipated our next question by shifting to sort of the post-contact record. And so you've talked about the effect of climate change on terrestrial archaeological resources and kind of a focus on pre-contact Indigenous history. But your other expertise is maritime heritage and shipwrecks. And so what sort of climate change effects are we seeing on maritime heritage and in particular, sort of like what's happening in the water?
Well, full disclosure, I'm not an underwater archaeologist. I know a little bit about how the Royal Navy outfitted ships for Arctic service.
This is a classic problem where Matt can't just have a hobby. He has to have a hobby that produces a book and involves becoming a technical advisor to an HBO series or something.
Well, but I can talk about it. I mean, it's no secret that underwater heritage is also being affected. And when people think about like coastal inundation, they often don't think of erosion, right? And so for most sites, when they become inundated, they're destroyed. For shipwrecks, these things sort of sink to the bottom. And in some respects, they're able to sort of weather these storms a bit better. But the problem is now with these increased intensity of storms, the currents and sort of sedimentation that occurs can either completely sort of wash away a wrecked site, or it can dump so much sediment that it completely obliterates a site from view. And so it's not just in the south, but in the Arctic as well. The longer periods of sort of ice-free ocean surface and the sort of currents that occur because of these major storms, that they're really affecting preserved sites in the Arctic as well. And so, it's not just the stuff that's on land; it's the stuff under the water as well. And you know, we talk about the coast a lot, but the interior is seeing just as much sort of destruction. You know, we've got these massive forest fires that hit every year, especially in Western Canada, but we're starting to see them in the East now too, which is sort of unheard of. Quebec is now becoming a major center of yearly forest
fires. Nova Scotia a couple summers ago, like where we were out there for a vacation, and there were like entire sections of the South Shore Highway that were blocked off because forest fires had ripped through there and destroyed cut off a bunch of like rural highways.
Absolutely. And so what happens is that over archaeological sites, when an archaeological site's burned over for about a year or so, it's a little bit easier to spot them, right? But after the loss of the vegetation...
Because you can see the hard hats where the archaeologists dropped them as they started to run.
That's right. But what happens is when this vegetation burns off, you get rain events and wind that essentially washes away all the soil that's not being pinned down by roots. And so you get this denution of all of this soil. And what happens is you can have a deeply stratified site that just becomes deflated in a couple of years. That's a horrible stratigraphic loss. It's not quite as bad as on the coast because the artifacts don't seem to be sort of displaced or washed away. They can be washed away by intense rainstorms, but they just sort of flatten out. And what you get is basically the loss of the stratigraphy from the site. And that causes major problems for interpretation as well.
But even on some of these islands, alluvial islands in like the lower Wollastoog, we were out surveying them last year, and on Ekpahog, there's an archaeological site that's plotted. And you know, it could be just a factor that the site was recorded early enough that the GPS location isn't accurate. But we were standing on the present day shoreline and the site was 100 meters out into the river. And you know, and we're walking along the south shore of that island, and there are slumps that are actively eroding that are about between 30 and 80 centimeters in width and are about, you know, a meter or so tall. And those are the ones that are slumping away this year. But we were walking on slumps that had fallen off probably in a previous year or maybe in the spring, you know, the ice kind of dragged past it. And so there are these like on the shorelines in the interior, along these river systems, you're losing, you know, tens of centimeters, if not meters of shoreline in some cases each year. And it's the same, it's the kind of the same processes. It's this, the spring freshet, which is a natural process where the, you know, where the snow melts and the river floods every year, is becoming more intensive because the snow melts much faster. And it's being scaffolded on top of that with like these rain events that are happening in like the late winter and early spring that are, you know, basically dumping so much more water into the river system than it can happen. And then it always seems to coincide with like, you know, a high tide or a king tide. And so all of the water is pushing in from the Bay of Fundy and trapping all that water in the lower reaches of the river and creating all sorts of knock-on effects.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, these 50, 100 year, like century floods that people used to talk about are now seemingly happening there every 5 years or so.
And there are two years in a row in 2018 and 2019, they had a 100 year flood in the lower reaches of the Wollastoog. And it's like, okay, well, that's not a 1 in 100 year flood. That's a 2 in 2 year flood.
And, you know, and so, you know, our bandwidth to sort of compete with, you know, people are seeing their front lawns wash away, bridges wash away, infrastructure, you know, roads being sort of undercut and bridges falling into the river. How do we compete with the public seeing that and then say, but, oh, you know, there's a burning library around every corner. And how do we compete with the loss of history at the same time that people are losing their sort of livelihoods and houses and infrastructure? It's really hard to sort of compete and say, you know, climate change is literally washing away the past. It's really a difficult challenge to sort of like to switch people's viewpoint from worrying about getting to work to worrying about their past being erased.
That actually kind of pivots to our closing question here, Matt, which is just kind of what sort of, I guess, how would you kind of make the case, make that case to the listener, or what sort of words of advice would you leave the listener or other archaeologists with about what to do? What are the next steps?
Well, you know, Tom McGovern is really the spokesperson for this, and I sort of adopted his message. And Tom is a really good archaeologist. He works in Greenland. He's the head of the North Atlantic Biological Association, NABO, and he's been working on climate change forever. And he has cautioned archaeologists to say that we actually have to start put down our pens and laptops and start picking up our trowels. And what he sees is a climate crisis that's so acute for the heritage sector that we have to stop theorizing and writing narratives about the past to just preserving it. And that changes the way archaeology is sort of done. In some respects, academic archaeology has sort of tried to move on from the sort of cataloging nature that archaeology had in the, you know, at the turn of the 20th century and up to the 1950s or so, this sort of culture history-based archaeology. But academia has moved on from that. So sort of highly theoretical sort of treatments, paradigm shifts are sort of de rigueur, the ontological turn, and everybody's writing sort of hyper-focused, detailed papers on how you interpret the past rather than sort of cataloging what they found. But Tom McGovern's saying, like, no, we have to go back to getting things out of the ground and doing the basic interpretation of when, where, what, and how, rather than sort of spending all of our time doing this hyper-theoretical work. Now, I don't know if I believe that there's space for both, but I do believe that archaeologists, their primary goal should shift. And we released a climate change statement in the CAAs that basically suggested that archaeologists have to change the way we do our work, and not just for us, not just to preserve the archaeological record, but to work with Indigenous peoples whose histories are actually being washed away. And so my not admonishment, but my advice for archaeologists is we have to change the way we work, or within 50 years there's going to be very little archaeological record left to work go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, well, so, and I think people, like, it is interesting. It's kind of interesting to see where this urgency is catching on. So, like, our hit piece today, like, that we're going to be talking about is this very recent, just came out, I think, 2 weeks ago, issue of Advances in Archaeological Practice. And the whole issue is dedicated to monitoring heritage sites at risk in rapidly changing coastal environments. It's mostly focused on the Southeast, but one of the things that Gabe and I learned is that there is now a North American Heritage at Risk group that is meeting weekly to talk about basic stuff like methods and how to get people, like the public, engaged. And you'll be happy to hear that there are, you know, like, one of the lines from the introductory is that we need to increase our human capacity to deal with these challenges, train people to collect data in the field and laboratory directly, in person, or remotely, to produce technical studies and planning and mitigation programs, and to educate, engage, and enlist public support. And so that is, like, the message is starting to catch on in some parts, and this is, like, mostly focused in the Southeastern United States. So I think it's...
Yeah, that's basically what our climate change statement said, is that we have to change the way we record and train new generations of archaeologists to focus on recovery and basic sort of archaeological standards, reporting standards, rather than highly theoretical treatments of the archaeological
record. Get back to the Mercury monograph series.
Well, this, you're preaching to the choir. This is something I've been talking about for a long time, and I think we even mentioned it in our book. But the site report is should be considered by archaeologists to be their meat and potatoes. These are the records that, and this is the record where you describe all of the artifacts, provide the catalogs, provide the illustrations, maps, and photographs. And archaeologists have sort of moved on from these site reports to doing it so kind of piecemeal, paper by paper. And what we find is that sites are not being cataloged properly by archaeological practitioners. And what really is required is people have to write up their data and basic interpretations, because there's no better person to interpret the basics of the site, the basic when, how, what, where of the site than the person who excavated it. And that data is crucial for others in the future who are going to be using this information to interpret the past, and also for Indigenous people who really need access to that raw data in an interpretable and more easily digested format other than field notes and lists. And this is something that I really feel strongly about. People have to get back to writing site reports, and it's going to have to involve a change in academia as well. And academics are going to have to start recognizing that basic site recording, excavation as well, site recording and site reporting have to be included as achievements that can be used to get themselves promotion and tenure and jobs, rather than seeing these peer reviewed publications as the most important standard to achieve. Our most important standard should be really good detailed site monographs and site.
Well, I don't use the phrase tenure on this.
Yeah,
program.
I was going to say I've got till fall 2026 for you to convince my dean about that, Matt. So why don't we start right now?
Give me his phone number. I'll try. But I firmly believe this, and as you know, it's much easier to access the information from sites excavated in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s when this site reporting phenomenon was important, especially in Canadian archaeology. But as the 90s hit, it's increasingly difficult to get access to sort of detailed site monographs that lay out the entire data. And that's a real problem, not just for the discipline, but for the people who depend on us to provide the data from the past, the sites that we're excavating that represent their history.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, I think we're all probably experienced, you know, at least in my master's thesis, for example, I wouldn't have been able to talk about regional comparatives, for example, of what a late maritime woodland site looked like all over the region without like big monographs, like the Carson Report or Teacher's Cove, like all of these ones that have these really detailed
placemaking in the Pretty Harbor.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but that have that, you know, the tables of all the metrics and everything, drawings, and so you have a sense like you can actually visit the site through that monograph rather than having to piece.
And it doesn't just have to be a monograph. I mean, Gabe, and I'm not sure if you were involved with that paper, but Gabe and his colleagues wrote a very comprehensive report on the Devil's Head site, which was essentially a monograph. Was it Devil's Head? Or
yeah, we did. Yeah, it's an article. Yeah, so it's the same kind of idea. Yeah.
Yeah, laid out all of the data, all of the maps in a very comprehensive way. But even those type of articles, you can't convince editors to publish them anymore. They want to see you answering specific minutia questions, often sort of blanket in theory. And you know, I love those papers too. I'm guilty of writing them. But I've kind of changed my focus. And, you know, Gabe was a collaborator in Port Jolly. And we purposely didn't write a paper after paper after paper because we knew we were going to write a monograph on it.
So I guess before we let you go, do you have, like, I guess on that topic, like what advice would you give to archaeologists out there? Like what are some venues that are
fast? Oh,
yeah, work fast. But like, but if you're shifting gears, like, are you targeting like the BAR report series? You know, like, I know I have an article that's going to be coming out in Archaeology of Eastern North America that is basically, it's really technical, right? It is basically describing my 15 years of work in the Washtenaw Lake area and outlining, like describing like 30 different archaeological sites. So there are some of these venues that people are, but like, you know, we've talked about the Mercury series as one option, and that's how you guys have gone. Like what advice would you give to somebody who's looking to put that information out there?
Well, there are venues. BAR is one of those series, although they tend to like to produce things based on semi-peer-reviewed theses. The Mercury series is always a channel. We're always looking for good monographs, especially from Canada. There are some presses in the University of Florida Press sometimes does like sort of big site monographs. But the other thing is trying to convince editors to say, like, this is an important record that needs to be published. You know, the cancer of the 10,000-word academic paper for archaeology has to be eliminated.
I've never been able to do it anyway, so that's...
Me too, but I understand why editors want to do that, because they want to publish more papers, yeah. But longer format papers and site reports have to have a place in archaeology. It's simply not possible for us to do our job effectively without that. And I think by opening up the ability to publish these sorts of things, both in monograph form and in journal form, will sort of invite the CRM industry into providing the stuff that they create in a published format. And so one of the reasons why I think we don't see CRM archaeologists publishing as much as they could in journal forums is because the type of data that they produce and the type of interpretations they produce, they don't feel are wanted by the journals and the publishing the publishers. But the type of data that CRM archaeologists produce, and that's 90% of the archaeology or more than 90% of the archaeology going on in North America right now, should be published and getting out there, but it's languishing in gray literature, as we all know. And part of the reason for that is they don't have any publishing venues. If CRM archaeologists working 40 years ago could easily turn their huge site reports into monographs and get those published, and it's important. The type of work they're doing is important, and they're largely working sort of in a culture historical paradigm. I don't want to call it a paradigm, but you know they're trying to place things in a sequence and make and sort of identify patterns using artifact typologies, because sometimes they're not using huge suites of radiocarbon dates, but that's important. And that needs to be seen. I can't imagine the vast amount of data that I don't know about from the Atlantic provinces that's locked up in CRM literature. It boggles my mind to think of the things I don't know. And if I don't know it, just imagine like the public and the communities we work with, how are they able to digest it if we can't even access it.
The listener can't see this, but Matt is about to burst out of a t-shirt that says culture history, sort of like the Hulk here. He's sort of straining at it here. We just thought we wanted you to set up the next episode that you're going to be on, Matt.
Exactly.
Oh, what yeah. Done here. Yeah, and I do. I feel strongly about culture history and as a fundamental product of the work that we do, and the importance of creating narratives from the archaeological records that are easily digested, not only by other archaeologists, but by the public. And I believe that the preoccupation with paradigm shifts and ontological turns has created a situation where archaeologists aren't doing the fundaments that they should be doing to preserve the record that they're creating for the future. And that's the thing, like, you know, we're destroying archaeological sites in our work, sometimes destroying archaeological sites that are in the process of also being destroyed by nature. But the fundamentals of recording that data and making it available for the future are being lost in the types of training we're giving our, not necessarily our undergrads, because they go into CRM archaeology, but our graduate students, certainly.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And so I kind of can't think of a better place to leave this off, and we're going to put the cult and culture history next time we have you on, Matt.
Yeah, we've gone from a sequel episode to setting the stage for the spinoff series that's coming up next.
Well, thank you for allowing me to discuss this with you. I really do think this is the most important thing that we'll do in our careers. If we can find a way to do it effectively, so much the better. But I know you guys are working hard, especially in the Northeast Archaeological Survey and Ken, the work you're doing on river systems. We're all engaged in it heavily. I just hope our other archaeologists will get involved as well.
Thanks very much for joining us, Matt. It's great to talk to you about this stuff.
Yep. Thanks again, Matt.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right, Ken, I think it's time for us to get to hit pieces.
I think it's time for hit pieces.
We've got a little bit of a different hit piece than usual this week. And I confess, I'm always a little bit intrigued to do this because, as you know, we are a direct competitor with the thing I'm about to recommend now, which we've just learned has 64,000 subscribers on YouTube alone. So there's a small upstart podcast, the Meat Eater Podcast Network, which appears to be by someone who's interested in hunting and conservation. A while ago, apparently interviewed David Meltzer, at least used to be from Southern Methodist University, I assume still is there, about why Meltzer thought Paleo Indians were not responsible for Pleistocene overkill. And this one, entitled "Did Clovis Hunters Kill All the Mammoths?" is an interview with Todd Surville at University of Wyoming and with Spencer Pelton, who I believe is the state archaeologist there in Wyoming, about why they think there was Pleistocene overkill. And so it's interesting, it's approachable, be loath to admit anything other than this particular episode without having dove further into this, but I found it very interesting. The guests and actually the host were quite good.
Yes. Yeah, so actually looking at this, it looks like they produce like a bunch of different podcasts, but that this one in particular, they have talked to archaeologists in previous episodes too.
Yes. I think they're interested kind of in the history of hunting and in conservation.
Okay.
So my understanding is that the meat eater thing here, it seems very bro-y, I'm not going to lie. But I think it's maybe a little more insightful than that would imply. I don't think I would have watched it except that I was interested because Surville, I think we maybe suggested this a while ago, an interesting lecture through Crow Canyon about Clovis population dynamics that I'd watched and thought was really interesting. I think that must be why YouTube recommended this to us.
And for the listener, just sort of like briefly, the Pleistocene overkill hypothesis is...
Which is actually one of our spare luchadors is called Pleistocene overkill. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Pleistocene overkill.
The premise is that, and as you alluded to, is that essentially there's been sort of two big arguments about what killed Pleistocene animals. So you're talking about your mammoths, mastodon, beavers the size of a car, like Volkswagen bugs, and all those fun things, and whether or not it was climate change that did this, or whether it was Clovis hunters that did this, or if it was some combination of between Clovis hunters overhunting and then climate pressures sort of driving this, and that there was sort of this feedback loop basically happening. And some of the ideas that have been put forward are, for example, that because Clovis, and this is one of the arguments, and I'm guessing this is what Surivel's argument is probably predicated on. I will admit I have not listened to this particular podcast, but that if Clovis were the first people here, you'd also be entering a continent where these animals were not used to having somebody hunt them, and so were actually much easier prey to catch. Mm-hmm. And that's been another argument for the overkill hypothesis.
And he also talks a bit about the archaeological record itself, including, so one of the interesting things he mentioned is the guy asked basically like, why are we finding whole Clovis points, lodged like in the animals at these places? And Surivel's hypothesis is that once you've killed one of these animals, you can't really flip it over.
That's a good point.
And I had really never thought about that. And I will say that this guy, I guess his name is Stephen Rinella, seems to have read a bit about the subject and also asks some questions that get interesting answers from the guests.
Yeah, well, that's good. This might be our first, it wouldn't be our first podcast hit piece.
Yeah.
The first one that we may fundamentally, alter your YouTube algorithm.
That's right. Yes. And we will not be, you might want to do this on your burner YouTube, if you have such a thing. But I will say, Ken, that, you pointed out they appear to interview archaeologists a fair bit. I'm intrigued. I think I'll probably, dip in a bit and see what they have to say. They seem to be sort of conservation-minded, which you would not know from the way that their studio is decorated.
But Ducks Unlimited are conservation-minded in the sense that they build wetlands to shoot ducks.
That's right.
Right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, so, yes. You can be conservation-minded and still be a big meat eater.
You absolutely can. Yeah. Although, I don't see any ducks in this place. These guys look like they like to eat bigger meat than ducks.
Maybe they're on a campaign to bring back the mammoth. Isn't that something that's happening?
Yeah, I think it is. Isn't that someone's very excited to have mammoth steak or something?
Yeah.
So I hope the listener enjoys it. I hope they find it similarly compelling. I'm not sure I agree with Surivel on this. I'm not 100% sure I agree with Meltzer either, but go ahead and take a listen.
Yeah. Yeah. An interesting perspective on an ongoing debate.
Absolutely. And help them catch up. I guess they're kind of a new podcast, it looks like. It's always exactly. Nice this time of year to remember other podcasts.
And put in the comments that you were directed there from the @NewBrunswickArchaeology podcast.
Yes.
To increase our SEO.
And that's right. Yeah. It's helpful. And the spirit of giving, really.
Exactly.
Well, Ken, I think we have fully bewildered ourselves temporally, per usual. And we want to be careful. We don't want the TARDIS to actually take us back to the Pleistocene, because I hate to break it to you, Ken. I don't think we would last too long out there.
No, I am a pretty poor flint napper.
Yeah.
Although I enjoy being outside,
mm-hmm.
I I could probably see myself being impaled by a saber-toothed cat.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I'm in the part of the world where they were definitely prolific.
Yeah. The I think hunting an elephant would be terrifying. even if I could make a Clovis point.
Yeah. And that's a good note to leave on, is that we started talking about Matthew Sawchuk's thesis, and Matthew made a point of saying today that his favorite animal is an elephant, and he celebrates all proboscideans past and present.
Excellent. I don't really know where to go with that except to begin recounting a particularly weird ESAF meeting I was at once. I can't remember if you were there. And I think maybe that's a story for another podcast, Ken.
Yeah. And listener, we'll talk to you soon. And just for on a scheduling note, we'll be running probably regular episodes every fortnight through May. But there will probably be a seasonal pause either in June or July, depending upon how our fieldwork schedules and things line up. And I think we've got some fieldwork content that's going to be coming down the pipe here in the next few weeks.
I think we do. And I think the other thing we wanted to say was, even though we've been grousing a little bit about our funding trouble, we would really like to thank the University of New Brunswick for providing us with some money to help get us through the rest of the season here. And so thanks very much, UNB.
Yes, thank you, UMB. And we'll talk to you soon, listener.
Bye, listener.